Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, across the airwaves. You just finished Doc Talk Podcast with Dr. Greg Roscoe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, ear, nose, and throat specialist. And now we find ourselves 60 minutes in Oakland, California, the Sports Talk Saturdays, hosted by Bruce Kessinger, Scott Morgenroth, yours truly, Mark Mancini, playing the board tonight. 347-205-9631. You can catch the archive version on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So more of these guys, less than me. First off, as they lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic. Bruce, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? I know you'll be giving it over to Scott, and boy, you got the 1980 World Series champ Warren Brewster in the house. So I'm just going to sit back and man this whole thing and listen to this great show with you three guys, my friend. Not Manny, Moe, and Jack, not the Pep Boys, but three knowledgeable guys.
Well, thank you, Mark, and here's how I am. I'm trying to see if I can call up some fielders for my team right now, and I can be reached at holyroller91978@gmail.com, or you can catch me on Facebook. Scott?
Well, I got a little grocery list, Warren, so pay attention to this one. We got it, all right? You can follow me on Twitter, at Tribune South. Go to www.southfloridatribune.com. But most of all, please subscribe, folks, to the South Florida Tribune YouTube channel. We have a lot of great shows on there. We look forward to having Bruce on there eventually. So South Florida Tribune YouTube channel. Please, folks, subscribe. You'll see everything that Mark and I throw out there. And Warren, of course, Bruce always has an open invite. So we have a lot of great baseball content as well as other baseball content and look forward to bringing it all to you. So we're going to have a dynamite show today. I've been really hyped and excited about this, Warren. And this is going to be an incredible hour to hang out with you guys. I've been really promoting it on my other shows as well. So let everybody know that this is a show you can't miss. So there you go. All right, Bruce, let's go out there and play ball with Mr. Warren Brewster.
Okay. Well, do we want to start off with Juan Soto? Let's do that.
Yeah.
You're turning down 15-year contract for a ridiculous amount of money, $445 million, I believe. I can't see anybody trying to take that on, period. I mean, I would trade for him and maybe give him a 3-year contract and even a little more just to see if it would boost my team over the top. But nobody wants to take that on. I mean, this is very similar to Durant. I think he's basically going to keep himself there. I don't know whether – or he's going to put himself on the market, I guess, at the end of the year or whatever, and then see what people will pay that kind of money. It's just amazing that somebody would turn that down. I'm stunned. Great player. But, you know, 15 years, you take it. You don't know what's going to happen to you. You're going to get injured, whatever. It's beyond words to me. What do you guys think?
Well, first of all, I'll give you two words, okay, Warren and Bruce. Scott Boras. All right. Scott Boras to me will do everything that he can to make sure his guy gets as much cabbage as he can. So, yeah, you think that's a lot of money to turn down? True. But you also have to understand that the Washington Nationals are in a state of flux right now. I understand that right now they're going to have one of the worst records in baseball. But number two, they're in the process of trying to sell the team. So if you want to gamble and watch your career waste away for an organization that you're not sure if can win, I definitely believe that $440 million is a lot of money to turn down. And not to say that I understand it, but I can certainly see both sides. Thinking he wants to play for a contender, and maybe if Washington's willing to offer him $440 million, who's to say who else is going to offer him? And then you have to wonder where he's going to go and who's going to pick him up if they have the right compensation. So that's my take, Warren. What about you?
Well, that's a ridiculous amount of money to turn down. But, you know, I think his thinking is he wants to play for a winner. And if they're going to move him before the trade deadline, obviously a team that picks him up is going to have, number one, want to sign him to a long-term deal. But it could be he could be the difference in getting that team over the hump as far as an offensive catalyst. He can fit in with any. Can you imagine him being in Yankee Stadium with Judge and Stanton and all those guys? That would be ridiculous, and the Yankees got the money to go out and do it. So, and they can sacrifice four or five prospects to have a run like that. And if he's happy there, sign him to a long-term deal. He's in the catbird seat right now. So he can determine, kind of where he wants to go. And could be the difference. He's won World Series already, and I think that's his thinking. As a player, I never played for the money. I wanted to win. I didn't care what it took. The money was very secondary. I wanted to be on a team that had a chance to win, and I was very fortunate in the 9 years I played in the big leagues. I was in the playoffs five times, and we did win one World Series. So, and that was more important to me than anything else, was to be on a team that had a chance to win.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bruce. Well, let's talk about your playing days with the Phillies.
Pardon?
Let's talk about your playing days with the Phillies. How much did you enjoy playing in the city of brotherly love? I know that they are certainly compassionate fans. They might be a little hard on you. Maybe the media is hard enough to a point where they want that Steve Carlton wasn't going to talk to them. Only imagine what it would have been like with social media back with Steve Carlton, but they'll leave that for another day. But tell me about what it was like to play in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, if it is that. I don't know. Is it?
It was a great town to play in. I was very fortunate in the time that I was there that we won all the time. And they're very demanding fans, and rightfully so. I mean, not only as a player, if you don't demand excellence out of yourself, you shouldn't be there. That's my opinion. And to play in a town as beautiful as Philadelphia, I loved playing there. It was a great, and more than anything, the owner of the team, Rulli Carpenter, the Carpenters were just outstanding owners. Rulli was just a beautiful man, and I loved playing for him. And once the Phillies were up for sale, I was ready to go elsewhere, because I knew it wasn't going to be the same, that a corporation's going to come in and run it, and you're going to lose that individual passion that the Carpenter family had for the game. So, that changed my mind immediately. But I loved playing in Philadelphia. And again, I was fortunate to play when we won and won the first World Series in franchise history in 125 years or however long the franchise has been in baseball.
Yeah, well, yeah, Dallas Green is your skipper as well. So, obviously, we know that Dallas Green is one of the most credible people in baseball, isn't he?
Yes, and very loyal. He is loyal and demanded. That you play hard. That's all he came in to do. He rules with an iron fist, but all he wanted to do was play hard. And that's all that matters when you come to the ballpark is today's game's over 3 hours, but to play hard for 3 hours every day is not asking a lot, because there's doesn't take any talent to hustle.
Indeed. And you had Pete Rose, who was the ultimate hustler there. Certainly an example setter if there ever was one.
Right. Great team. Amazing the things that he was so intense and just never let up. He would have it at bat. If he made an out, he'd come back into the dugout, sit on the top steps, and just sit there and like, look where the shortstop is. He's two steps over to his left. Here comes a fastball in. He knew exactly what was going on. He could tell by the fielders, the way they positioned themselves. He'd look at the pitcher. He looked at the whole game and just was very intense and taught us players. Mike Schmidt, Larry Boa were just, everybody idolized him in the game because he played so hard and he knew so much about the game and how intense he was.
So we're talking about Pete Rose, and obviously I'm going to give you the most obvious question on the planet. Pete Rose, in my opinion, belongs in the Hall of Fame. We all know that he bet on baseball, not allowed to do it. But still, I've seen a lot of choir boys next to the Hall of Fame that don't belong there. So I got to ask you, Warren, does Pete Rose belong in the Hall of Fame? And then I'll provide you with a follow-up question or two that will probably further validate what the Hall of Fame stands for. But let's talk about Pete first.
Right. You know, without question, as an ex-teammate of his, you know, obviously the all-time hit leader, the greatest hitter that ever played the game, you know, he definitely belongs in the Hall of Fame. You know, and to me, it saddens me to see the home run leader Barry Bonds not in the Hall of Fame. Roger Clemens won 7 Cy Youngs. Nobody's ever going to do that again. And none of these guys are in the Hall of Fame. You know, it's sad that, you know, what does that say for baseball?
Okay, I mean, I slight disagreement here. I do think Pete should go in at some point. I don't know when, but he did bet. I mean, the gambling thing, it's not so much that he bet against his own team. I don't see him doing that at all. But when you bet on your own team and you're managing it and you're making moves that are there to make you money versus moves that I think that were good for the team, you might overplay players, you know what I mean, or people are hurt because whatever. I thought that's kind of an insult to the fans, especially in the town where you are beloved.
Right.
But yeah, that's, yeah. And the other thing too is the steroid issue does bother me, but then again, the hypocrisy of allowing Bud Selig to go into the Hall of Fame, who knew full well that was going on, in my opinion, and ruined a perfectly good season with the strike, you know, it throws it all out the window. And I'm kind of like, do I really want to go to the Hall of Fame? Do I really want to see people that I disagree with being in there and all of that stuff? C-League, no, it just doesn't work for me. And I don't like the way, in basically his protege now is running baseball, I don't like either. So it's like it's tough for me as far as Pete and the steroid guys are, because, you know, but now that you have Selig in there, what the heck, let everybody in.
Yeah, right, you know, that's, yeah, right, exactly. It's, you know, there's a fine line there. You know, how many guys in that era were on steroids? I would venture to say 75 to 90%. I hadn't been in the clubhouse.
Wow.
7 or 8 years, and I went into the clubhouse in the mid-90s, early in 93, and said, oh my God, look at the size of these guys. The little middle infielders weigh 200 pounds now. When they weighed 150, 160 pounds when I played, you know, everybody was huge. It was just, it was amazing. You know, it looked like a place, Gold's Gym or something like that. It wasn't a clubhouse. It was, you know, the guys were just there. It was amazing. I was just shocked at how big they were.
Well, you know, Warren, amazingly enough, okay, the Oakland A's and the Detroit Tigers drew about 7,000 people for a doubleheader, okay? So we know the inevitability. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, as it appears right now, that the A's are headed to Las Vegas. So we all talk about when Pete Rose should or shouldn't be in the All-Star game, or not the All-Star game, but rather the Hall of Fame. So with that said, okay, is Las Vegas ready for baseball? Because we're talking betting, and you're talking about the gambling capital of the world. I realize gambling's all over the place, and we know that I think the only way Rose ever gets into Hall of Fame is when he's dead, really. They don't want to even give him the gratification that he'll ever see it while he can go out there and say it. So posthumously that is, but let's keep the attention on Vegas and Oakland going there. We're talking about MLB, or just about on the verge of going to Las Vegas, a gambling area, and yet we're talking the double standard that Pete Rose isn't in there for obviously gambling reasons. Again, I'm not going to say that he covered it up well, doesn't belong. I get that he's paid the price for sure, and I'm not defending him going in. I'm talking about more and more like a double standard here, that Vegas is ready for baseball, gambling is now accepted, Rose isn't in, and he's made a lot of mistakes on the way that, unfortunately, you make your bed, you sleep in it. But, you know, let's talk about Rose and the gambling connection tied to the Oakland A's, and is Las Vegas ready for baseball?
Well, I think, you know, the one thing that's helped Las Vegas is with the hockey team and the football with the Raiders being there now. So it's kind of opened the door for the town, and those professional sports have kind of led the way to see what kind of gambling and what's going on in the sports to allow them to play there, you know. And for me personally, I'm an Oakland A's fan, always have been since they've moved to Oakland. And to me, it frustrates me to see them have to trade all their players away when they get to the point when they're going to become free agents and make a lot of money because they can't afford them. They can't put people in the seats because of the ballpark. They need a new stadium, and if they can't get that done, then the next best thing for them to do is move. And they go to Las Vegas. Now they can be competitive. They can sign their free agents, and they can be way more competitive, and they don't have to turn over every 3 or 4 years and lose all these stars that they've produced in their farm system. You know, they and the Tampa Bay Rays are two of the best farm systems. They produce more players, more stars than any of the other teams in baseball. They have to be competitive, and it's amazing the job that those two franchises have done to be competitive from year in, year out. You know, Oakland's on a downside right now, but Tampa Bay seem to have figured it out, and they've been competitive constantly for the last 10, 12, 15 years. You know, that's that. You have to tip your hat to those guys. They do it without a lot of money, and they're in a division where Boston and the Yankees just they go out and they'll buy whatever they need, and the Rays stay competitive with them. You know, to me, that's you've got to be very impressed with the way they run their organization.
I was going to say, as an Oakland A's fan, I don't know if you heard about this. It's kind of an insult to injury situation. I think the team could stay in Oakland if John Fisher was willing to sell it. They said supposedly there's a standing offer from Joe Lacob to buy the team, the Warriors owner. He also almost had the team when Steve Schott was selling it, and here's another reason to not like Bud Selig. Selig decided to turn it over to his old college mate, Lou Wolf, at the time. Now, if Lacob got the team, I guarantee you they would stay in Oakland. He would certainly become a Bay Area legend in the sense that now he has teams on both sides of the Bay. And I honestly think it would have happened then, and it would happen now if he had it, that you would get your stadium done and you would have a quality team on the field because that guy believes in it. And I don't know that Vegas or even Oakland with another stadium can trust John Fisher to even put money into a team. He's not interested in baseball. He's interested in real estate and making a lot of money. I don't even cares about the sport. I'd really like to see him stay in Oakland. Vegas, you're right with the hockey and the Raiders there, that they stand a chance of doing something. But I would love to see them sell it, and Joe Lacob would be just perfect. What do you think? You think there's anybody who'd want to buy the team?
Well, yeah. I mean, if Joe Lacob bought the team, that would be outstanding. I mean, I was watching the Warrior game when he bought the Warriors, and the fans, they introduced him at halftime or before the game or whatever, and the fans were booing him. And he goes, the guy just bought the team. You're booing a guy. You don't even know what he's going to do. And what has he done?
Well,
they've won
I can tell you why they did that.
In the last 8 years. I mean, it's amazing the job that he brought in the right people. You know, Bob Myers and Steve Kerr run that organization, and they're at the pinnacle of the game. You know, and if he could do that and buy the A's again, he would turn that franchise around, and they'd be competitive. You know, growing up in the 70s, early 70s, well, they won 5 championships, American League West championship, division championships, and win the World Series 5 years in a row. You know, it was amazing had they not free agency hit, they would have won at least 3 or 4, maybe 5 more world champions in that era. They were a phenomenal organization, you know, and it'd be
by the way, that was
get back there again.
Yeah, that was the last time the Warrior fans, by the way, booed Joe Lacob because he traded Monte Ellis for an injured center and somebody else. Nobody thought that was a good trade. And guess what?
Right.
He hasn't been booed since. It was a great trade. It was the catalyst.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yeah. So we'll take a break here. We got the fans giving us a call here. We've got Albert from Poway saying his Padres are going to do some damage in the playoffs. Dodgers are tough, but not going to do anything in October. We'll let the baseball man himself say it. Warren, what do you think about it?
Well, I love the way the Padres are built. You know, they've been, and I was kind of bewildered by him last year, not being, you know, having a tough year. And I think they grew a lot from it. The reason they didn't have the success last year was because the pitching staff was hurt. You know, they took a chance on Clevinger. He's healthy again, and he's outstanding. You know, so their pitchers are just, You know, and that's pitching and defense is what wins championships. And when you get down into a short series, into a best of seven, you're not going to see that fourth and fifth starter maybe. You might only see one, two, and three, and they're stacked. Their pitching is what's going to carry them. And then if they get Tatis back and he can have any kind of season or half season that he's had in the past, they're going to be tough to beat, you know, and it's they're going to play some good baseball. It's going to be exciting to watch the Padres. They are definitely a team to watch out for. I don't think anybody would want to play them in the playoffs right now.
Okay.
So Warren,
and we've got
Warren,
go ahead.
Here, I'm sorry, Warren, let me ask you a question. You guys talked a little bit about steroids a little bit. We know David Ortiz is going into the Hall of Fame. You know, I that's subject for debate. It's not like he got in there with a ton of votes, but he's going to go in anyways. Do you think he does belong in the Hall of Fame, as not only for what he did with Boston, but he's a folk hero, very popular and all that. And, you know, let's face it, Big Poppy is an icon. He could trademark that all day long, help the Red Sox get, you know, the curse of the Bambino is history because of Ortiz, as well as the other Red Sox. But what's your take on Ortiz? And I should point out, I do agree with you guys on Joe Lacob. I think you do some great things as the owner. And you also make a good point, Warren, that if it weren't for the Vegas Golden Knights and the Raiders breaking ground, then maybe baseball doesn't. So I want to get that in. But let's go back to David Ortiz. Does he really belong in the Hall of Fame? And does this open up the doors for other guys? Because I know Pudge Rodriguez was a questionable call as well.
Right. You know, and you know, what he did for the city of Boston is just phenomenal. You know, they had some issues with the marathon problems and issues with the city, and he stepped up and really took the city and put it on his shoulders, you know. You know, and that's off the field, but it's, you can't help but commend the guy, you know, and that helps because the people that put people in the Hall of Fame, the baseball players in the Hall of Fame, are writers. And when you show that you're a human being and are doing the best for your city or your community, you know, I can't help but sway some votes. So, you know, that aside, you know, he had an unbelievable career. You know, let go by Minnesota. They didn't want him. And then all of a sudden he gets to Boston and just takes off. Whatever happened, I don't know. But, you know, just he had a phenomenal career. Yeah, and he did. He was one of the instrumental people turning that organization around and finally winning a World Series.
I got to tell you, 1987, I worked for the Gastonia Rangers, Texas Rangers system, and I worked with Sammy Sosa, Juan Gonzalez, and 10, 12 other major leaguers, and it was unbelievable. I saw how small Sammy was, and Sammy and I developed a good friendship over that year. So for a lot of Cubs fans that are probably listening to our show, I remember Sammy when he wasn't very big, and obviously you saw how big he gets. I know that we all talk about steroids, you know. He hasn't really totally been – they haven't proven that he's done it. Unfortunately, I think maybe the cover-up may be overshadowing what he did because of body size. So, you know, any thoughts about Sammy Sosa at all?
Well, yeah, he's another guy. He and Mark McGwire that season that they had the home run race, you know, that turned baseball around. It was right after the strike and got the fans interested in the game again. They were it was great for baseball, you know. It really helped the game, and you know, again, we've talked briefly about it, and Bug Seeley just kind of turned his back on it, and they let all that stuff go. You know, Tommy Glavine and Greg Maddux had that commercial that said the chicks dig the long ball, and people do.
I remember the ballpark.
Yeah, I'm a pitcher, but I'd love to go see a 10-8 game where guys are scoring runs and teams are going back and forth. It makes it exciting, and you know, 1-0 games and pitching duels have their, you know, their time and their place. But I'd come to the ballpark, and even as a player, to see offense. I was fortunate to play in Philadelphia with some very offensive players. You know, it was fun every night because we never knew what was going to happen. How many times Bull was going to hit one, and Greg Wasinski was going to hit one in the upper deck, and Mike Schmidt played pepper with the left center field tarp. You know, it was amazing, the offensive game. Then we get Pete, who are the all-time hit leaders. You know, we had an unbelievable offensive ball club.
Well, I think we also have to remember, I'm sorry, Bruce, what Sammy and Mark McGwire did. As they drew people in from batting practice, they'll sit here and tell me the clubs weren't benefiting because of the extra concessions, the souvenirs that you were selling. But meanwhile, they did. You're right. They did save the game. Cal Ripken Jr. in 94. How long did it take for baseball to recover from that? But I think baseball owes it a lot to Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire. I'm not condoning about the substance stuff. That does not do it. But it goes back to what you were saying, Warren, about Bud Selig looking the other way, knowing that they practically broke the union. So, you know, there's that little slippery slope where, yeah, all right, we can penalize these guys for not putting them in the Hall of Fame, but I truly believe that Sosa, McGwire, and Cal Ripken Jr. saved the game and got baseball on the right track, and everybody, to me, treats that like people disrespect Vietnam veterans. I'm not trying to make this a political thing, so I'm not going there. But I think these guys deserve a little bit more respect, and as more and more guys get in, do the veterans committees and all these other people go out there and at some point get them in as well. So I know we're going in a lot of different directions, Warren, but I like the way you're answering things, and I'm confident that you can give us some candid opinions about some of the things I just mentioned.
Yes, definitely. I was fortunate enough to play for the Cubs for 3 years, and it's not a more beautiful place than Wrigley Field. And watching the wind blow and the wind change what's going to happen every day. Every morning when I woke up, I looked to see which way the wind was blowing, especially as a pitcher.
Yeah, on another level, I'm kind of against DHs going into the Hall, and I'm not against the DH, period. It doesn't show that you're a complete player. But I was going to ask you, and with the DH now in the National League, the batting average is still going down. So what's your opinion about that, that new rule? I would against it. I like the strategy. And I like you say you like 10 to 8 games and there's a place for 1 to nothing. I'm always partial to 4 to 2 myself. I'm not liking it. I think there's certain teams that were hurt by it in a weird way, the Giants, because Kapler was inserting pinch hitters at the right time, et cetera, especially when you have the rule where the pitcher has to, you know, do at least 3 batters, which I'm not saying is wrong or right. But I think, you know, with all the tinkering in a way that the DH is being banished from the NL has hurt the game. And I never liked the DH anyway. I always liked it when guys like Gates Brown came out of the dugout and you'd have a hush over the crowd because he's hitting 400 as a pitch hitter and everybody was anticipating what was going to happen. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, you know, the National League game definitely was, you know, way more strategy because the pitcher had to hit. And it changes, the DH has totally changed the game. You know, you don't have to take the pitcher out if he's pitching well. At least in my era, there was these things called complete games. And
yeah.
Those sit on definitely by the wayside, you know. And for
me
as a pitcher, I would have enjoyed pitching in the American League because my job was to come in, get ground balls, and as soon as my turn at bat came, I got pinch hit for. Where had I pitched in the American League, I could continue to pitch. But that said, there's way more strategy in the National League, and then us, and you know, in the 1980 World Series, we have two of the best pinch hitters that ever played the game, in Greg Gross and Del Unser. You know, the frickin' frack. Del Unser got a huge hit in the top of the ninth inning in Kansas City to propel us to Game 5 win, put us up 3-2, and coming back to Philadelphia on a Tuesday night with Steve Carlson on the mound. We were feeling pretty good about ourselves coming back to Philly after leaving Kansas City, getting beat 2 out of 3. And still feeling, you know, it's over. With Lefty on the mound on Tuesday, we're going to win a World Series. And so,
yeah,
you know,
indeed.
But in the same respect, the thing that bothered me the most was in this era, or in the last 5 to 8, maybe 10 years, the pitchers not only had a hard time hitting, but they couldn't sacrifice and move runners. And as the only thing I could do was bunt. I couldn't hit, but I could bunt. And I took pride in my bunting and being able to move the runner over. And as a starting pitcher, when that 8th place or 7th place hitter are on base and there's less than 2 outs, and you're moving him over and putting him in scoring position, you're giving that leadoff hitter, top of the lineup, a chance to score for you. And the guys they've lost that ability, you know. So, you know, I'm pretty much fine with the DH. It changed the strategy of the game. But, you know, in the same sense, the pitchers kind of let me down, you know, by not being able to bunt and move runners over and not even, you know, look like a lot of times they wanted to just get out of it. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. And it's a chance to help yourself win a game.
Well, you know, I got to mention a couple points. Thanks a lot, Warren, for setting me up very nicely. Thank you. All right. Number one, Mickey Lolich, okay, is one of my idols. And why this guy isn't in the Hall of Fame to me is a guest that I've had him on one of my shows before. But Mickey Lolich was an innings eater. Few people realize he beat, won three games in the 6-8 World Series. And you talk about complete games, there you have it. So, you know, so to me, I love Mickey Lolich. I think he's a guy that doesn't get there. Hopefully one of these days he will. I'll bet you probably ran across one of my good friends through on the trail, Tom Gage, former sports writer for the Detroit News. And you probably know Tony DeMarco as well, since he's a prominent writer as well. But now I got another guy here in Miami, though, Warren, named Sandy Alcantara, who did not get the start on Tuesday night in favor of Clayton Kershaw. Now, let's not kid ourselves, okay? In my opinion, the reason why Kershaw gets that start is it's in L.A. It really is, okay?
Right.
I mean, in any other ballpark, I don't know about Anaheim as much, but Sandy Alcantara, to me, is a guy that will eat up a lot of innings. He's a stud. Joe Davis was giving him the props, and John Smoltz. So when you talk about the fact that I got a stud, I love watching Sandy. I work with Don Mattingly on a regular basis. So I am really disappointed that we don't get as many complete games as we did back in the time that you played. And I should point this out. I had a chance to see Shohei Ohtani against the Marlins when he pitched, and that was one of the few things that I can honestly say that a pitcher helped his own cause, which doesn't happen these days. So, again, you know, I'm with you all the way, Warren. Shohei Ohtani, to me, brought back memories of what baseball was like when you help hit for your own cause. I got a guy like Sandy Alcantara who wears the Rodney Dangerfield cap out in L.A. for not getting the start in favor of Clayton Kershaw, and yet I am really pulling for Sandy to get a start anywhere, but we knew what was going to happen in L.A. So take it from there. You got a lot to swallow on this one, Warren.
Right. Well, you know, as a fan now, you know, even before I played, I was always a fan. I'm still a fan today. I still love the game, but for me, I was hoping that Ohtani would pitch against Kershaw because it was in L.A., you know. And to me, as a player, you're honored to be in an All-Star game. If you get to play, that's cherry on top, you know. And I think a lot of the players that go to All-Star games feel that way. It's a little different in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and even in the 70s, where the guys, the starting players played 6, 7, 8 innings. They played the majority of the game because that's what the fans wanted to see. Can you imagine Willie Mays and all his 24 All-Star appearances getting one at bat and then that's it? Oh, man. I mean, the things that he did, Ted Williams, I just read a quote the other day that said the All-Star game was made for Willie Mays. And these great players, Mickey Mantle, all the great players of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that if they just got one at bat, you're robbing the fans of seeing these guys. They should at least get 2 or 3 at bats every game. You know that the fans are voting them in, and they take one at bat. You know, maybe sometimes in some instances 2 at bats, and then they put the extra guys in, or that the guys that were also voted to the team. And for me as a fan, I want to see the superstars. I want to see them get at least, you know, they should play 5 or 6 innings at least. And
yeah, like an actual baseball game.
Turn it into a game, you know, where your best players are competing against each other. But on the on the other hand, Sandy Alcantara is an absolute stud. I enjoy watching him pitch. I have the baseball channel. I watch games as often as I can, and if he's pitching, I make a point to at least watch a couple innings where he's pitching, because he dominates the game. He's an outstanding young pitcher that's got a great future ahead of him. And the Marlins have turned it around. They're a team they're in contention for a wild card. They got a chance of being in the playoffs, and that's all as a player. That's all you ask. Get in the playoffs. Just let us in. And whatever happens, happens. and with, you know, momentum, the teams that have won in the past few years, Atlanta winning last year, wild card team, Washington doing it a few years ago. These wild card teams are, you know, they're on a push to get to the playoffs, and they're kind of on a roll. And your pitching, it gets on a roll, you never know what's going to happen. And I think that's what's, you know, it's good for baseball, because once October 2nd comes, everybody's on an even playing field. Everybody's at 0-0 again.
Well, people can land on my Marlins all day long. I don't care. But Sandy Alcantara, Garrett Cooper, Jan Stidham, who, by the way, was voted in there, didn't play because of a back injury. What few people don't understand about my Miami Marlins is they've won two world championships, and they've been there three times, all as a wild card. So, Warren, yeah, that validates everything you need to do. Get in the playoffs, and anything can happen. This team doesn't lose much in the postseason. Really, it's basically a matter of us getting to the postseason. But, you know, hey, we have two World Series titles on our, you know, banners to show for it at Marlins Park. So I'm with you all the way. I really do. And I think that when you talk about today's game, though, Warren, the thing that really seems to bother me a lot, I don't know if it bothers you, Bruce, or Warren, but I don't feel that a combined no-hitter is a legitimate no-hitter. Yes, it's a team stat, but how do you take guys out, you know, 7-8 innings and you have a no-hitter, much less complete game? That, to me, is unfortunately the thing that's really hurting baseball. I realize there's a lot of money being paid to these players. I get it. But you know what? I'm going to stand by what I've said on numerous broadcasts, Warren. A combined no-hitter to me is not legitimate.
Right.
I'm with you.
That's like the no-hitter with an asterisk next to it, because it took four or five guys to do it, you know.
Right.
And that's, you know, to me, that's, you've got to be pretty lucky to do that. But there's nothing better than watching. I mean, as a fan, again, if I see, I get it on a heads up on my phone, guys got a no-hitter into the fifth or sixth inning, I flip the game on. And I want to watch, you know, how he goes about. I remember watching Randy Johnson when he pitched his perfect game. I got a notification like in the sixth or seventh inning and watched the end of the game, and he was just dominant. And nobody had a chance that night. And it's, you know, that's the fun part of the game to watch, you know. And a guy like Sandy Alcantara, he's got no-hit stuff every time he takes the ball. You know, it's fun to watch those guys. You know, there are guys like that. Scherzer's like that. DeGrom's like that when he's healthy. There's quite a few, you know, there's six or eight dominant pitchers in the game today that every time they take the ball, they got a chance of throwing a no-hitter. And then it's you know, and it's also fun to watch an obscure pitcher that's had, you know, a mediocre career, and they go out and throw a perfect game. You know, they that one day, they're just unhittable for whatever reason. You know, Joe Musgrove for the Padres threw the first Padre no-hitter. As a San Diego kid, grew up in San Diego. You know, good for him. You know, it's something to be very proud of. He was the first one to throw a no-hitter in all the great pitchers that the Padres have had in the past. He's a San Diego boy, grew up, born and raised there, and threw a no-hitter. You know, good for him.
Well, so, Roy Halladay and Roy Oswalt, to me, represent pitchers from the past that could have pitched in any era, because those guys did throw nine innings a lot.
Yeah.
Roy,
I was in the organization. I coached in the organization when those guys were there. And I saw Roy Oswalt come up through the minor leagues. And, boy, he had just had dominant stuff. He was just lights out. And, you know, the resurrection that Roy Halladay had in his career, having the worst ERA, having a 10 ERA one season, and turning himself around by realizing things had to change. Changed his arm angle and just took off and just was an absolute dominating pitcher for 6 or 8 years of his career before he had arm problems that ended up causing him his career. And then he had Cliff Lee, Cole Hamels I had in the minor leagues, and Cole was absolutely dominant in the minor leagues, just a phenomenal talent. You'd tell Cole something and boy, he picked it up right away. I mean, just, you know, and the good players can do that. Baseball is a game of adjustments, and your superstars adjust immediately. They don't have any problem adjusting. It's great athlete. Cole was a great athlete. And then Joe Blanton, the fifth starter on those teams. Oh boy, you go to bat with any of those five guys any day. You know, you've got a chance as a position player. You're coming to the ballpark with a chance to win every day.
Yeah. We have Sal from Germantown in your area. Scott mentioned Mickey Lolich. So Sal here left Mickey Lolich off this says, it's Carlton, Guidry, Glavin, and Johnson on the Mount Rushmore of Southpaws. This sort of leads me to Steve Carlton, and he didn't talk much to the press or anybody. You really never knew anything about him. So maybe you could give us a little bit of insight on the man there, Warren.
Oh, he was a great teammate. He was, what he did was he talked to little things, just the little adjustments that you make. I can remember we were in Chicago one day, and one of our relievers, Kevin Fauchier, asked Lefty, he said, how do you throw your slider? Best slider that ever played, best to ever play the game. And, and Lefty's, you hold it like this and throw the bleep out of it. And about 5 minutes later, he came back and he said, your arm angle, the higher you get your elbow, the more downward break you get, the flatter your elbow, the flatter the break. So the count determines where my arm angle is going to be, and you're talking just minuscule, just a matter of inches. And I listened to that, and all of a sudden, whoa, when I threw a slider, I let the count dictate what I did with my arm angle. The higher, when I was ahead in the count to make it go down more out of the strike zone, or if I needed to throw it for a strike, higher, and then if I needed to throw it off the plate, flatter and a wider, bigger break, and that was just a little things that just increased my ability just by hearing that, and he did things like that on a regular basis because of the knowledge. And that's what, as a rookie, you sit there and you listen. You listen to what these veterans, and they guide you. Ron Reed, who's going to be inducted to the Wall of Fame in Philadelphia in a couple weeks, was a great mentor. He took me under his wing as soon as I got to the big leagues and showed me the ropes. This is how you warm up. Once you're warm, throw a pitch, every pitch with the pitcher. Don't burn yourself out, because as a young rookie, I'm eager. I'm all excited, and I end up throwing 100 pitches in the bullpen and don't have anything when I go to the mound. I've already used my bullets in the bullpen. So you learn these things from veteran players. And then as I got to be a veteran and you have the young kids come up, you teach them the things that you were taught, and that's the great thing about baseball is the camaraderie as the veterans go, because you realize your career is not going to last forever and you pass on with the knowledge that you've got, and I was very fortunate to play with a Steve Carlson and to have a Hall of Fame pitcher in that clubhouse every day. He didn't talk to the press. He got burnt by the press in the mid-70s and said, that's it, I'm not talking, and was a recluse. But as a player, as a teammate, he wasn't. He opened up. He was very knowledgeable and shared his knowledge on a regular basis that helped not only, helped all of us and helped everybody become a better player, and that's what Pete did for the organization when he came in. He helped Mike Schmidt, Larry Boa, the everyday players become better players just by his knowledge of the game and kept them on to, you got to play hard. That's all we got to do, and he did a lot of amazing things.
Well, amazingly I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, I was gonna read it. We got Joey from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Actually, did come up with the question here, which is, why did Steve never deal with the media? He might have gotten burned by a reporter trying to sell a sports section. Do you have an answer for that one there, Warren?
Well, no, that happened before I got there. He was already not talking. So, what went on prior to that, I'm not really aware of. So, I can't comment on that. I just know that was what I was told, that he'd gotten burnt, and that's as far as I know.
Okay.
So going back to the 80s when you were there, Warren, I have a feeling we crossed paths because, I covered the Phillies and the Tigers over at Jack Russell Stadium in Clearwater.
Oh, yeah.
And I was hoping to break the Carlton code, but when I couldn't do it and everybody kept saying you're not going to do it, one of the fans there said they had Von Hayes out there, and he said, and how critical they got on him because he was traded for a handful of players, Right. You know, I'm not going to get into names. It doesn't matter. But
right.
I decided to, let's forget about the Carlton thing, and I ended up writing a story on Von Hayes, which turned out equally as well, and I wasn't when I knew I couldn't get Carlton. So I understand the nature of the Philadelphia media. I've gone to that area many, many times. But let's face the reality, okay? In a day like this where, you know, times have changed, how would you have handled social media in your playing days? Because it was hard enough to deal with regular traditional media. Social media has made the sports world and turned it upside down.
Well, the way I saw everything was I was happy to be there, you know, so I was more than happy to accommodate anybody that wanted to talk to me. And a lot of people didn't talk to me, you know, so, you know, I was a middle reliever, you know, and I played on some great teams with a lot of superstars, and, you know, I was just happy to be there, you know, and the social media today, you know, and I always, the days I had bad days, you know, as a fan, I would have booed me too. So, you know, so I accepted that. I didn't have any problem with that. And being a reliever, you have a bad day today, you got to be ready to come to the ballpark the next day and forget about that. You know, and the next day is a new day. The sun's going to rise and it's a new day and you get back on a roll. You have bad days. But fortunately for me, I had a lot more better days or good days than I did bad days.
Okay.
You probably know a friend of mine, Mark Littell. Know each other?
Yes. I've done a show with Mark. Yes.
Yeah, Mark is a truly great guy. Sorry, Bruce. Go ahead.
Right.
Hey, you know, we hear you're going to have an alumni game in 2 weeks in Philadelphia. What exactly happens in an alumni game?
Well, we can't play anymore. This is 40 years. We did play an alumni game in 1990. We did play, I think, 3 or 4 innings against Kansas City. They brought the Kansas City Royals in Philadelphia. No, we're not playing. It's alumni weekend. I can't even lift my arm anymore. So, and a lot of, you know, the majority of my teammates are late 70s, early 80s now. You know, and I don't think too many people want to see us go out and play.
Nor do the fans want to see guys with walkers running to first base.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, them in wheelchairs. It's an alumni weekend. Philadelphia has that the first weekend in August every year. And we're being saluted. The 1980 team is being saluted. We couldn't have our 40th reunion 2 years ago, obviously, for the COVID. And now they finally feel comfortable and having us come in this August for our 40th reunion, which, okay, it's now 42 years. And the majority of the guys are still alive, and it's going to be great to see teammates that I haven't seen in probably 25, 30 years. I did fantasy camp for about 15 years, and Greg Luzinski was there every year. Keith Moreland came a couple times. Bob Boom was there from time to time. Mike Schmidt showed up. Larry Bowe was there. So I did get to see my old teammates, a lot of them from time to time, in fantasy camp over the years. So it'll be great to see some of the guys that I haven't seen. And the last time we had anything was our 25th reunion. So it's been 17 years since I've seen some of them.
Warren, there is no way we could do a show without mentioning Bryce Harper, who I think could play in any era. For a guy that hits as well as he does, he runs in the wall. In my opinion, you could have put Bryce Harper in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and now. I've seen him play quite a few times. I am so impressed with everything about Bryce Harper. We talked about Soto at the beginning of the show, leaving Washington to go somewhere else. And, you know, who knows where he'll land. For all we know, he could end up in Philadelphia, too. You never know. I'm not sure. But let's talk a little bit about Bryce Harper. Yeah, I've seen. And Joe Girardi obviously couldn't crack the Phillies code there. I know we're going into some things. But let's keep the focus here on Bryce Harper. Do you think that this guy could have played in any era? Because I love everything about his game, from his defensive prowess to whether he's running in the wall, diving, and his hitting. Bryce Harper, to me, is the it's the type of guy that Major League Baseball should build and market its stars around, and he's certainly one, along with Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani and many more, that you need guys like Bryce Harper to keep the great
American pastime relevant.
Right. Oh, I agree with you 100%. Yeah, I mean, he could play in any era. You can hit, you can hit. And he's a great hitter. I mean, he the things he did at such a young age, 16 or 17, leaving high school to go to a junior college to make himself a better player, to play against better talent, just to make himself a better player. Just the things, the way he went about getting to where he got, you know, it's just the absolute superstar, you know, and just plays hard every night, you know. So he's, you know, he's a team or a player that everybody in baseball, they can market. You know, he does the DQ commercial with Tim Anderson, and he's on a lot of national spots and is a great ambassador for baseball. You know, plays hard every night, is a team leader, you know, and leading the Phillies have a chance of making the playoffs for the first time since 2011. It's been a big drop in Philadelphia, and he's a guy that he's a leader and came into Philadelphia with the idea of turning that franchise around and making it a winner again, and seems to be headed in the right direction. They still need a little bit of pitching, but as far as the everyday players, they've got a solid lineup. It's got a chance to contend. If they get enough pitching, they have a chance.
Well, we know Philadelphia is a demanding area, but how is Bryce Harper being received? Every now and then you can boo a guy, boo Santa Claus out there. But there is,
right,
I think,
right,
if there's one guy who you can't boo, it's Bryce Harper, because this guy gives everything that he can when he's out there. He's ready to put his life on the line, you know, to do what
right,
he does. And,
right,
again, I'm not trying to be hypocritical with the fans out in Philly, but let's face it, to me, Bryce Harper is a dream that every team can only hope to have on.
Well, from what I've seen about Bryce, the times he gets himself into trouble is when he tries to do too much. He is such
okay,
a great offensive player. He'll swing at balls out of the strike zone and chase pitches by trying to do too much instead of realizing, you know, now I think he's a lot better suited. You know, his average is way higher this year than it has been in the past few years because he's got more guys around him, Castellanos, you know, JT Realmuto, he has better hitters or, you know, top-of-the-line hitters around him, and he doesn't have to. I think he's finally realized that, and it's been, he's had a very productive year. In fact, I was at the game the night he got hit in the hand by Blake Snell and broke his thumb, and I was there that night in San Diego. And, you know, it's a shame that he's on the shelf for 6 to 8 weeks. You know, and that's the one thing that has hurt the Phillies is they to be and have any consistency this year is the injuries they've had. It seems every time they get rolling and win three or four in a row, they have a big injury to one of their top players. And Gregorius has been in and out of the lineup. Segura's hurt. He's been out for over a month to 6 weeks now. You know, Harper's been out over a month. And it's frustrating. I know it's got to be frustrating for the Philly fans, and it's frustrating for the players that every time they get on a roll, so they have a major injury to one of their superstars. You know, and that's tough to overcome. It gives the other guys chances to step up and be productive and see what you have in the organization down in the minor leagues, because every once in a while they get a kid Hall. That's come up. He looks like he can swing it. You know, he's a left-handed hitter and he can hit with some power. And that's the type of player you need in that ballpark. It's a bandbox there. It's a lot of home runs and it's a very offensive ballpark. And the Phillies have kind of modeled their team after that. The lack of pitching has hurt them in the past. The bullpen has killed them the last few years. And it seems that they've shored that up a little bit, that they've got some guys that can pitch seventh, eighth, and ninth and close out games.
So that leads me to my next, Joe Girardi. Do you think that he got a raw deal in Philadelphia?
Well, you've got to be there on a daily basis to know that. You know, and I was shocked when they did fire him because he's had success everywhere he's been. He's had success. Why he didn't have success in Philadelphia, you'd have to be in that clubhouse on a daily basis to understand that or to know why. Yeah, I was very surprised that he couldn't turn that team around. And make them a winner. And then now Rob Thompson's taken over, and they've done nothing but win since he took over, you know. And he may have changed things. He may have changed the attitude in the clubhouse. He may be pulling the right strings with the pitchers and having a little different idea how to use them than they did when Joe was there. You know, it's the little things that happen. You know, I know the difference when Danny Ozark was my first manager and then Dallas took over. There were just subtle differences that Dallas did that Danny didn't, and it changed us from tender into a winner. You know, it's the little things that happen that, you know, and more power to Rob. He finally has his opportunity to manage. You know, he's had some intern managing in the past, but now it seems like he's got a job in Philadelphia because the team's winning and they're in a lot better standing than they were with Joe. Why? I can't tell you. I couldn't put my finger on it, but I know in that clubhouse that's the little subtle things that he's changed that's turned them, you know, turned their attitude around or whatever it is to winning ball games.
Okay. We've got about 5 minutes to go on the show. I was going to say one last question from me quickly. You know, you were talking about Bryce Harper and, you know, the kind of thing that fans like or the player you like. The attendance has gone down a little bit here in baseball. Is there anything you think that they need to do to market it to get more people to come or, you know, I don't know.
You got to get some offense. You got to get some offense back in the game. What the last I heard, the major league average now is .242. And the biggest thing is, you know, I think what's hurt the game is the way the guys swing the bat today. They go up there, they either strike out, walk, or hit a home run. So they don't put the game's not played like it was when we were kids, where you put the ball in play and speed and stealing bases and sacrificing runners. I was watching Oakland A's game about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they bunted for the first time. That was the first time they bunted the whole season. They'd played 75 games, and they just their first sacrifice bunt. You know, that was strategy of the game. Of course, then again, you know, a lot had to do with the pitchers because we had to bunt. But, you know, the strategy of the game has changed. They're signing kids that can launch balls 400 feet. That's what organizations want to see. They want to see kids swing the bat. If you strike out 200 times, no big deal. If you hit 40 home runs. So they're sacrificing putting the ball in play to hit home runs. You know, and so it's changed the game, and there's not a lot of action. And I think they need more action, and they've got to do something to get more offense into the game.
Okay. So go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, well, we're getting down to the nitty gritty here on the time. I was just going to ask Warren how people can get a hold of him.
I can be reached at Brewster Brusstar 40 at gmail.com.
And well, Scott, what was that last question? Maybe we can get this in.
Yeah, I'll give you a quick yes or no on this one. Do you think Joe Girardi lands another managerial job? Yes or no?
Oh, I definitely think so. Yeah, he's a very knowledgeable. If not, he's a bench coach for a young manager. You know, because I mean, and you see in the baseball history, who are the best managers? They're always catchers because they've got a different perspective than everybody else out on the field. They're looking out at the field where everybody else is looking in, and it's amazing how catchers have such a outstanding perspective of the game and have always had great success. And Joe's had great success everywhere he's been. You know, again, why he didn't have success in Philadelphia, I don't know. You'd have to be in that clubhouse on a daily basis to know. But he's a great baseball man, and I think without question he gets another job. You know, he's still a young man.
Okay. And Scott, how can we get a hold of you?
All right. You can follow please subscribe to the South Florida Tribune YouTube channel, or you can find me on Twitter at Tribune South, website www.southfloridatribune.com. Any of those three will work.
Okay. And I can be reached at holyoler9198@gmail.com or on Facebook. And for next week, folks, come back in 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. We will have Craig Elo as our guest. And for Scott Morgenroth, for Mark Mancini, and thank you for being on, Warren Brewster. We wish everybody a fine, happy weekend and look forward to you seeing you or hearing from you, rather, next week.
Thank you, Bruce and Scott, for having me on and being able to talk about the game that I love.
Pleasure's ours. I'll be in touch, Warren.
Okay, Scott.
Thanks, guys.